Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Spanish Civil War, a very short introduction, by Helen Graham, narrated by Jonathan Davis.
Chapter 1. The Origins of Spain's Civil War. Long live those who bring us the rule of law. The Spanish Civil War began with a military coup. There was a long history of military intervention in Spain's political life, but the coup of the 17th through 18th of July 1936 was an old instrument being used for a new purpose. It aimed to halt the mass political democracy set in train by the effects of the First World War and the Russian Revolution, and accelerated by the ensuing social, economic, and cultural changes of the 1920s and 1930s. In this sense, the military rising against Spain's democratic Second Republic was the equivalent of the fascist takeovers that followed the coming to power of Mussolini in Italy, 1922, and Hitler in Germany, 1933, and which were also designed to control similar manifestations of social, political, and cultural change. It may at first seem paradoxical that the clash between old and new should have erupted into full-scale civil war in the relative backwater of Spain. First and foremost, however, we need to remember that the escalation from military coup to civil war, and then to a modern total war involving the vast majority of the civilian population, was crucially dependent on factors that were external to the Spanish arena. It is also true that when Spaniards retrospectively attribute the causes of the Civil War, they often describe thoughts and feelings that were produced by the war itself. Notwithstanding the currency of ideas about two Spains ready to confront each other on the 18th of July, 1936, us and them were categories actively made by the violent experience of the war and did not fully exist prior to it. Nevertheless, even in the immediate aftermath of the July military coup, and before any international factors could come into play, extreme forms of internecine violence were already occurring virtually throughout Spain. So historians are required to explore what this violence meant and how it related to the pre-war domestic environment. Three factors were crucial here. First, the extremely uneven levels of development that obtained inside Spain by the 1930s. This meant that the military coup unleashed what was in effect a series of culture wars. Urban culture and cosmopolitan lifestyles versus rural tradition. Secular against religious. Authoritarianism against liberal political cultures. Center versus periphery. Traditional gender roles versus the new woman. Even youth against age, since generational conflicts were also present. Second, the force with which the opposing elements clashed owed more than a little to the cultural influence of a Manichaean brand of Catholicism that still predominated in Spain, affecting even many of those who had consciously rejected religious belief and the authority of the church. Third, since the detonator of events was a military coup, we must also examine the role played by Spain's army, and in particular, the emergence of a rigid and intolerant political culture in its officer corps during the early decades of the 20th century. Crucial to all of these factors, but especially the military, was Spain's final loss of empire in 1898. This deprived the country of its protected external markets, and in so doing, kick-started an intermittent and acrimonious debate over how Spain should modernize itself economically and who should bear the cost. The arguments in favor of domestic reform made by Spain's relatively more progressive industrial elites, especially those based in the Catalan textile sector, made little headway. They came up against the interests of an entrenched agrarian sector that was inevitably more powerful in a country whose economy was still mainly based in agriculture. The large landowners whose estates dominated the southern half of Spain would have been the elite sector most affected by economic and political reform, Temperamentally, too, they were inflexible. Many were the fathers and elder brothers of Spain's officer elites, groups known for being profoundly suspicious of change. The loss of empire deprived Spain's overlarge officer corps, which had been inherited from the continuous wars of the 19th century, of any meaningful external defensive role. In so doing, imperial defeat turned the military into a powerful internal political lobby, determined to find a new role while guarding against any loss of income or prestige in the interim. To take the sting out of defeat, there grew up within the officer corps a powerful myth that civilian politicians had been uniquely responsible for the final loss of empire, and thus had little moral claim on governing the country. This belief was already deeply ingrained by the time the 15-year-old Francisco Franco entered the military academy in 1907. A generation of officer cadets came to see themselves as the defenders of Spain's unity and hierarchy, and of its cultural and political homogeneity, as consubstantial with the country's historic greatness. Indeed, many in the military elite took this one step further, interpreting their defense of this idea of Spain as a new imperial duty, thereby interpreting in reverse the monarchical constitution that defined Spain's colonial territories as provinces of the metropolis. What was deadly about this new interpretation of imperial defense was that it came to be directed against other groups of Spaniards, who symbolized the social and economic changes occurring in the towns and cities. These changes were slower than in some other European countries. But by the second decade of the 20th century, urban Spain was on the move. Towns like Seville and Zaragoza grew as industry, albeit on a small scale, expanded beyond the traditional areas of the north, coal mines, iron and steel foundries, shipbuilding, and northeast, Catalan textiles. Similarly affected was the Valencia region on the northeast seaboard, where urbanization and industrial development reinforced an historic anti-centralism or federalism. These economic changes and the developments that accompanied them, such as better communications and transport, and the relatively freer circulation of new ideas, created new social constituencies, an urban professional sector, and industrial workers, both of whom increasingly wanted a political voice. The traditional order, with its highly restrictive franchise, was thus coming under increasing strain in urban Spain. But another country existed that was still far less affected by these demands. This was rural and provincial Spain, La España Profunda. Most of Spain's 20 million people, 21,303,000 in 1920, still lived in villages and small towns. In the center and north, the bulk of the population were peasant smallholders, most of them of modest means, some very poor. This rural society was serviced by the populations of agrarian or market towns, inhabited by a provincial middle class of similar social attitudes. It was a rigid world bound by the ties of custom and tradition, in which a conservative form of Catholicism provided the common language, value, and culture. The close relationship between church and community in center-north Spain was cemented by the crucial pastoral role played by local priests. Not only did the church provide spiritual solace, but also practical support, often in the shape of rural credit banks that offered a life-saving resource to an impoverished small peasantry, perpetually threatened by crop failure, and fearful of falling prey to moneylenders. The reciprocal desire of church and community to protect the other stemmed from a common fear of dull-rumored change and an identification with an older, cherished world of order and hierarchy. Many identified specifically with monarchy as the form of government best able to protect this order. The church hierarchy clung to it, not least to stave off the consequences of encroaching political liberalism and cultural pluralism, both of which profoundly challenged its own monopoly on truth. For by the early decades of the 20th century, the Catholic Church in Spain already felt itself to be under siege. Not only did it have little authority among urban workers, but the teeming poor of the rural South were also long lost to it. The agricultural laborers of Spain's deep South viewed the church as a pillar and perpetuator of a landed order that oppressed them. Southern Spain was dominated by massive estates, worked by landless peasants whose lives were a constant struggle against starvation. The norm of huge estates growing a single crop meant that laborers were dependent on a sole source of income, which even then was only available for part of the year, at planting and harvesting times. In the absence of any public welfare provision or other forms of poor relief, this dependency turned the landless poor into virtual slaves at the disposal of landlords and estate bailiffs. Laborers were brutalized by estate stewards and the rural police, the hated civil guard, who shot unemployed workers foraging for acorns and wood on estate land. The fact that the local priest invariably acted as the ally of the landowner and police chief made the rural poor fiercely anti-clerical and turned religion in the South into a viciously divisive issue of politics and social class. The systematic abuse of the powerless made violence endemic in this tightly repressed rural society. But the periodic slave revolts of the rural poor were easily repressed by the police, no less after the First World War than in earlier periods. Nevertheless, in urban Spain, the First World War was, as elsewhere in Europe, the crucial detonator of social change. Spain did not participate militarily, but the war produced both an economic boom and also severe forms of inflation and dislocation that drastically affected poorer sectors of society, both rural and urban. It was in urban Spain, however, that the resulting social protest seriously alarmed elite groups, who now viewed indigenous protest through the lens of the Russian Revolution. The epicenter of the threat was Red Barcelona. But for the Spanish establishment, the specter was not Bolshevism, but the city's powerful anarcho-syndicalist trade union movement, the CNT. It was committed to direct and often violent action against intransigent employers who conspired with the military authorities, and even in one notorious case with a high-ranking army officer, who was Barcelona's civil governor, to assassinate leading CNT trade unionists. In order to quell labor unrest in Barcelona and reimpose conservative order across Spain, a soft military coup was made in 1923 by General Miguel Primo de Rivera. It was welcomed by the reigning monarch, King Alfonso XIII, who strongly favored military over constitutional solutions to the problems of government. The dictatorship's way was also eased by the economic boom of the 1920s. But at the same time, this intensified the demands of urban middle-class sectors for political reform. They wanted constitutional rights as a defense of their own interests against the arbitrary power of the dictator. Political parties were illegal, but the 1920s saw the spread of professional associations, of teachers, post office clerks, and doctors, among others, a process that effectively saw sectors of Spain's middle classes republicanize themselves in a quest for political rights. Accelerating migration to the cities in boom-time conditions and the spread of radio to educated metropolitan constituencies also dramatically increased the distance between urban Spain and the villages and small towns of La España Profunda. That modernity was breaking through could also be glimpsed in the dictatorship's own contradictions. In spite of Primo's brief to restore conservative order, he also sought to implement a number of key reforms in the army and the sphere of labor rights. But even a military dictatorship found itself blocked here by corporate military interests, while the landed elites thwarted the extension of key social reforms to the impoverished masses of the rural South. When army opposition finally brought Primo down in January 1930, the king found himself compromised. With the groundswell of Republican sentiment in urban Spain, the Catholic Church was the only institution of the old regime unequivocally to back the monarchy. The memory of the dangerously novel elements of the dictatorship may, paradoxically, have made the prospect of a republic seem less momentous to elite groups in consequence. Indeed, when the republic was declared peacefully on the 14th of April, 1931, it may even have been viewed as a useful means of pacifying the popular opinion represented by the jubilant crowds thronging the big city streets. But those who believed that the republic would simply be business as usual, the political order of the monarchy without a king, were soon disabused. The first republican administration was determined to give the new regime a content of reforming policy that would affect a fundamental redistribution of social and economic power in Spain. Those backing a reforming agenda constituted two distinct groups. First, the progressive republicans, a political class of mainly lawyers and teachers forming grupuscules rather than mass parties. Precisely because they lacked electoral muscle in what was now a political system based on universal suffrage, the republicans required the backing of the second group, Spain's socialist movement, political party and trade union. A historically moderate and reformist political organization, the socialists were the only mass political movement in Spain when the republic was declared. While they were focused on social reform, wishing to introduce a mini welfare state, the republicans' objectives centered on structural reform. They saw themselves as the heirs of the 1789 revolution in France and sought to open Spain up to Europe, implementing economic and cultural modernization on the French model in four crucial respects: reform of land ownership, education, state-church relations, and the army. Agrarian reform was intended to create, in southern Spain, a small-holding peasantry with a republican allegiance, whose increased purchasing power would also provide an internal market that could stimulate industrial development. Church and state were to be separated and the public subsidy to clergy phased out, thus releasing resources to fund a national system of non-religious primary education, through which the republican nation would be made. Army reform was intended to bring the institution under civilian and constitutional control. Reducing the size of the top-heavy officer corps would also cut the salary bill and thus generate more funds for structural reform. All the republican reforms, as well as the social welfare legislation of their socialist colleagues, were designed to increase economic democracy as the essential prerequisite for establishing political democracy. Progressive republicans were above all constitutionalists, though they understood that many more of the economically and socially dispossessed had to be included before the republic could effectively implement the rule of law. But understanding a situation is one thing. Having the power required to implement the necessary measures is quite another. The republic's was an immensely ambitious program of structural reform. Indeed, it was almost certainly too ambitious to attempt so much at one time. Even worse, the attempt was being made at a time of world economic depression, when the new government was saddled with a burden of debt from the Primo dictatorship. But it is also understandable that republicans and socialists felt there was no time to delay. It was half a century since progressive political forces had been in power, and then only very briefly, in the First Republic of 1873. So the perceived backlog of reform, again viewed in comparative European perspective, was considerable. However, the inherent complexity of structural reform, combined with the difficulties the government had in finding experienced personnel, also unsurprising given the left's long exclusion from power, only added to the problems rapidly gathering on the new political horizon. For inevitably, the reforms raised opposition among Spain's traditional elites. The response of the ecclesiastical hierarchy struck an apocalyptic note even before the Republic had begun to make policy. The pastoral letter issued by the Cardinal Primate on the 1st of May, 1931, contained an incendiary royalist homily that caused the government to require him to leave Spain. His call to the faithful to mobilize in spiritual and patriotic rearmament came close to declaring the Republic an illegitimate regime. Moreover, the public words of other bishops did so overtly when they described the Republic as the triumph of error and sin. The strain of ideological apocalypse was evident, too, among sectors of Spain's military elites. Since the end of empire, the officer corps had become an increasingly self-enclosed caste. The military academies overwhelmingly favored the sons of officers. The daughters of officers married into military families. This was a world where people had fewer and fewer personal ties to other social groups. A new small-scale colonial venture was begun in Morocco in the early years of the 20th century. But the experience of the North African campaigns forged a brand of warrior nationalism that only further hardened military attitudes. Indeed, it was among the officers who made their careers in the colonial army of Africa, including Francisco Franco himself, that there would emerge the most fatally reductive views of what was wrong with metropolitan Spanish society and politics. When in 1927 Franco took charge of Spain's main military academy in Zaragoza, he put in place a teaching staff dominated by these colonial officers, the Africanistas. The academy became the forcing ground for ideas of imperial rebirth, of the military as the guardian and savior of Spain, and was thus an integral part of an emergent politics of the ultra-nationalist right. The idea of a squad of soldiers saving civilization would be given its final and most extreme form by European fascism in the 1930s. José Antonio Primo de Rivera, the leader of Spain's fascist party, the Falange, quoted Oswald Spengler's classic formulation from The Decline of the West, Volume 2, 1922, a text that, like the Africanistas' own remedies, was a pathological symptom of social change, rather than the solution it proclaimed. One of the Republican government's very first decisions in June 1931 was to close down the Zaragoza Military Academy. It also froze battlefield promotions made during the Moroccan campaigns, thus enraging the Africanistas. Not only were many officers hostile to the Republic's goal of imposing civilian and constitutional control on the army, they also found it affronting their ultra-centralist principles. For the Republicans and Socialists, though quite centralist-minded themselves, were prepared to devolve some political powers to the historic nationalities of the Basque Country and Catalonia as an exercise in regime building and democratic good faith. But questions of political culture and ideology aside, a no less crucial issue for young army officers was that of salaries and career prospects. Republican reforms would inevitably curtail both. Even the military dictatorship of the 1920s had come adrift when it attempted to interfere with army prerogatives. This did not bode well for despised civilian politicians, Republicans to boot, who were bidding to reform the army head-on. In the end, the coup of July 1936 would find its most consistent supporters in this junior officer class, which stood to lose most materially and was also profoundly hostile to the idea of a pluralist democracy. But these officers stood to lose no more in 1936 than they had in 1932, when a first coup attempt was tried unsuccessfully. Nor was the apocalyptic strain necessarily headier later rather than earlier. Something had certainly changed, though mainly this did not have to do with the military. What would eventually arm the military coup of July 1936 was the emergence and growth of mass political opposition to Republican reforms among civilian sectors in Spanish society. Resistance to reform came then not only from Spain's old elites. People of the middling sort in the center-north conservative heartland also began to raise their voices against the new republic. This mainly had to do with the church. The republic's secularizing reforms upset deeply Catholic sensibilities in this region. There was always going to be ecclesiastical opposition to measures such as the separation of church and state. But what caused most popular offense was the Republic's interference with the Catholic culture that framed social identities and daily life. For example, the way the new authorities restricted religious processions, or the ringing of church bells, or their interference with ceremonies and celebrations organized around local saints or local appellations of the Virgin Mary. This was a world of private and family devotions, but also of communal piety, where deeply felt emotions had as much to do with an allegiance to a way of life in a specific place, the immediate locality or patria chica, as with religious faith or spirituality per se. Or rather, loyalty to these things was indivisible. It was because these local worlds were felt to be threatened by Republican reform, but also by larger processes of accelerating social and economic change of which the Republic was seen to be a part, that religious revival played such a significant part in popular opposition to the new regime. At Esquioga in the Basque Country, there were new Marian apparitions in 1931, when people reported seeing visions of the Virgin Mary. Large pilgrimages ensued. As the social history of 19th and 20th century Europe shows, religious visions tend to occur at times of trauma-inducing upheaval. Common triggers are economic crises, epidemics, war, and political persecution. Although it is not usually a conscious process, religion then takes on an additionally powerful meaning as a defense against new and frightening things. The Republic's phasing out of the secular clergy's stipend also alienated many poorer priests who had not necessarily been irreconcilable opponents. But Catholic mobilization in 1930 Spain was predominantly that of lay people, who well before the Civil War itself came to see themselves as engaged on a crusade to defend an endangered way of life. This was equally true, whether in the rural fastnesses of northern Navarre, where the quasi-theocratic Carlists, radically opposed to all manifestations of social and cultural modernity, were training their militia, or among Catholic youth in provincial towns and even in the big cities, who became activists in the new mass organizations of the right. This mobilization included, paradoxically, support for votes for women, while progressive Republicans were far more hostile to female enfranchisement. Believing that the greater influence of Catholicism among female constituencies would bring a block vote for conservative candidates. Women would vote for the first time in Spain in November 1933. Certainly, the religious issue could be manipulated, as it was when the large landowners of the South successfully used it to mobilize poor northern smallholders against an agrarian reform that damaged only their own interests. The politics of mass popular conservatism were, nevertheless, more than the product of elite manipulation. It is equally true, however, that the political forms of this new conservative mobilization would have been inconceivable without the well-established organizational networks of the Catholic Church in Spain. Republican reformers got the worst of all worlds. They legislated to debar the religious orders from teaching, believing that they represented an insuperable barrier to the creation of a republican nation in Spain. But in practice, as a result of both subterfuge and legal delays, the attempted debarment failed. When the Civil War erupted in the summer of 1936, there still had not been a period of republican government when religious personnel had actually ceased to teach in Spain. Yet in attempting such an exclusion, the Republicans had mobilized a powerful coalition of conservative forces against themselves. Given budgetary constraints, too, it is hard to see how the Republic could, in the short term, have entirely replaced the Church's role in primary education. Republican secularization was then impolitic, ill thought out, and largely counterproductive. Some commentators have also argued that it was ethically questionable. All the more so, given that the Republic had staked its own legitimacy on constitutional principles. But this is less straightforward than they imply.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?